Asian, I texted them. It turns out ESPN was worried that an Asian announcer with the same name as a dead Confederate general might trigger some of their viewers and lead them to become offended, so they'd removed him from the game. Shortly after confirming the story, I published it on OutKick, and immediately it blew up, becoming a modern-day metaphor for the absurd lengths people and companies will go to when it comes to political correctness. ESPN caught flat-footed by my story, issued this statement acknowledging that my story was accurate. We collectively made the decision with Robert to switch games as the tragic events in Charlottesville were unfolding, simply because of the coincidence of his name. In that moment, it felt right to all parties. It's a shame that this is even a topic of conversation, and we regret that who calls play-by-play for a football game has become an issue. The story to me is a perfect encapsulation of the failures of identity politics and the pursuit of cosmetic diversity over intellectual diversity. Far too often in America today, companies of all stripes, but particularly in sports media, want people who look different but think the same. ESPN has cultivated that exact kind of groupthink. Frankly, most media entities in sports have too. That's how no one raised their hand at a corporate meeting discussing Robert Lee and said, "Guys, maybe I'm totally out of line here, but do you really think any of our viewers are going to conflate a dead white Confederate general and a living Asian man? And even if they do, what's the worst thing that could happen here? Someone might make a joke on Twitter and say something like, 'Looks like Robert E. Lee is doing whatever he can to sneak back into Charlottesville,' and show a picture of Robert Lee calling the game." So I've got a suggestion. We open with both men in the booth and have them identify themselves, and then we don't show them on the screen again. We don't put their names under them when we see them talking in the booth, so no one can screenshot it and make fun of his name. But if someone makes a joke on Twitter about this, it's going to last about 15 minutes and then be gone. On the other hand, if we pull this guy off the game and word gets out that we did it, and we should assume word will always get out on stories like these, what do we lose then by looking way too sensitive to an issue like this? ESPN didn't have a single person who said that. Why? Because all of ESPN's employees look different but think alike on issues such as these. They're all left-wingers whose audience is predominantly, especially in college football, voting Republican. That disconnect is incredibly problematic because it leads to decisions like these. Here's an important point that is rarely stated. The people who are most zealously advocating for diversity in the workplace, and by diversity they mean different colors, not different ideas, aren't doing it because it benefits society. They're doing it because it benefits them directly. In the opening of this book, I talked about the Missouri protest as my red pill moment. That was the story that propelled me to examine my surroundings in a new light. I've written about the difference in treatment for liberal political views as opposed to conservative political views in sports. Jemele Hill was protected when she called Donald Trump a white supremacist, and Curt Schilling was fired when he supported a transgender bathroom bill in North Carolina. But I've also seen the difference in my media career. Many times I've been asked why, given the fact that I have a thriving radio show, a dominant online platform, and a huge audience daily on Periscope and Facebook Live, I don't have a daily television show. The answer is because I was told I'm too conservative for sports television. Really? Let me explain. In the spring of 2015, Jamie Horowitz, the president of FS1, offered up the morning TV slot on FS1 to me. The proposed 3-hour morning show on Fox Sports would feature a former athlete and me, would air nationwide on Fox Sports Radio, and would also be simulcast on FS1. Horowitz agreed the show could air from Nashville. I haven't wanted to move my family from Nashville because we have a great life here. It seemed like a perfect fit. The only catch was I couldn't do the show alone. We needed to have a former athlete on with me as a co-host. And that co-host had to be black. Horowitz's viewer data led him to believe that the show we'd be going up against, Mike and Mike on ESPN, skewed white, and the opportunity for ratings and growth required that the show going up against them feature black talent. Coincidentally, I'd been talking about doing a radio show with Eddie George for a while. That had nothing to do with Eddie's race. I believe that his football background, Heisman Trophy, NFL, and Big Ten bona fides would play well in the middle part of the country with my SEC fandom and lack of athletic talent. Plus, Eddie lived in Nashville and loved the idea of doing the show. So Eddie and I traveled out to Los Angeles and did a guest show together on FS1. After that broadcast, Horowitz and his crew didn't believe that Eddie and I would be contentious enough for a TV show. That is, we didn't embrace debate enough. So he tabled that idea and said we needed to find another black guy to co-host with me. For anyone who has ever done daily radio, chemistry with your co-host is important, and I wasn't willing to agree to appear with a guy I didn't know well. At that point, I told them thanks but no thanks on the TV and radio show simulcast, and I decided to start doing my daily Periscope and Facebook Live shows instead. Now, you can say that decision was crazy. Who passes up TV and radio for an unproven medium like Periscope and Facebook Live? But Pete Vlastelica, my then boss at Fox Sports Digital, was extremely enthusiastic about the idea, and along with a crew in digital, we designed the first ever daily sports show airing on multiple mediums. That show, which cost virtually nothing to produce, has thrived. So much so that when I spoke at the University of Tennessee recently and asked the hundreds of kids in the crowd there how many of them had watched the show on their phones, every hand went up. When I asked the same group how many of them had a cable or satellite subscription of their own, not one hand went up. Look out, cable. To their credit, my bosses at Fox Sports Radio, Don Martin and Scott Shapiro, didn't care what race I was. They just wanted me on the air. In September 2016, we debuted the radio show nationwide with me as a solo host, and it has since dominated in its time slot, becoming the most successful morning show in the history of their network. With our surging ratings and rapid affiliate additions and podcast downloads unlike anything FSR had seen in the morning time slot, the Fox Sports TV crew took note. At the 2017 Super Bowl, Jamie Horowitz and I went to lunch and he offered me my own TV show on FS1. The offer came with new stipulations. I needed to give up talking and tweeting about politics and pop culture. From Donald Trump to Game of Thrones, give it all up. All Horowitz wanted me to do was talk about sports. He offered up Skip Bayless as the perfect example of who my TV role model should be. He said he'd taken Skip from making $150,000 a year to $6 million a year, and he could do the same for me because I was every bit as talented as Skip and much younger. I asked him why I couldn't talk about politics and sports when I saw other people on FS1 and ESPN regularly talking about politics and sports. He told me that was different because they were talking about politics from a liberal perspective, and that was okay, but advertisers didn't like when you talked about sports and politics from a conservative perspective. As a Southern white conservative, his description of me, not my own, I didn't have the same freedom to mix sports and politics as a liberal would. This was, in many ways, the lesson learned from Rush Limbaugh's analysis of the way the media covered Donovan McNabb. No one, at least not yet in sports, has ever lost his or her job for being too liberal. I'm not opposed to talking about politics and sports, as all of you reading this book can tell. I'm opposed to talking about politics and sports if it's done from only one side and with no integrity or intelligence. If someone wants to argue Colin Kaepernick is a hero, that's fine, but someone else should also be able to argue he's a fraud. Right now, that doesn't happen in most sports media. We're confronted with an artificial debate question. How heroic is Colin Kaepernick? That artificially stifles the marketplace of ideas, creating the exact opposite of a robust debate. By the way, the fact that I, a two-time Obama voter who has never voted Republican, worked for the Al Gore presidential campaign, worked on multiple Democratic congressional campaigns, and is pro-choice and anti-death penalty and fine with gay marriage, am considered too conservative, is perfect evidence of how far left-wing sports media has gone. When Horowitz made his offer to me, and asked that I give up talking about anything but sports, I specifically asked him what he'd have me tell my audience, which loved the fact that I talked sports, politics, and pop culture. I'd tell them, he said, thank you for getting me here, but I don't need you anymore. Now, it's important to note that I respect Jamie's TV ability and talents. Indeed, it wouldn't shock me if somewhere down the road we end up working together. In fact, the two of us are very similar. We both have tremendous faith in our instincts and the courage of our convictions. I don't blame Jamie for trusting his instincts instead of mine. After all, he knew Skip Bayless-style TV worked. He'd turned Skip into a superstar and made tens of millions of dollars for ESPN off a show built around someone like Skip. It makes sense that he'd want a younger Skip for the next generation. But for better or worse, I trust my instincts too. You don't go from an online readership of zero in 2004 to a thriving multimedia business in 2018 by doing what other people tell you to do. If I'd listened to everyone else, I never would have left a secure job practicing law to write a book about SEC football. And when you have two people who both trust their instincts and those instincts tell them different things, it can be hard to get a deal worked out. I talked over the offer with my wife, my agent, with lots of talented people at Fox Sports whom I respect immensely, with sports media people outside the company, and ultimately decided to turn down the TV offer. I never said a word publicly about either of these TV offers until nearly a year later when the New York Daily News reported the news in the wake of Jamie Horowitz leaving FS1. But when all of this happened, I took another red pill. I was explicitly told that my political opinions weren't allowed in sports, but that liberal sports opinions were allowed. In other words, exactly what conservatives allege, that much of the mainstream media conspires against any opinions being shared that aren't left-wing. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's an economic reality. Furthermore, people of color are far from being discriminated against. Many companies are actively trying their hardest to recruit people for jobs based on the color of their skin. I have been in countless meetings for both writing and TV where executives have begged for suggestions of young black guys or girls to put on television based solely on their race. That seems crazy to me. Shouldn't sports of all places pick the best person for the job regardless of their race, politics, gender, sexual preferences, or ethnic background? Television and radio, to me, are just like sports. Either you have the talent to perform at a high level or you don't. Every morning, I sit down in front of a mic and talk to a massive audience without any safety net for 3 hours of live radio. There isn't a single line scripted or a single prepared comment. Just like sports, what I do is intensely competitive, and you can either do it or you can't. What I look like has nothing to do with whether or not I can do it well. It's a meritocracy, which is exactly as it should be. I hope I'll do television again one day. Right now, I believe I hold the record for most unaired pilots in FS1 history. But if I do, it will be on my terms and with substantial creative control. Because if there's one thing I've learned, it's that when I can be completely honest with my audience, good things happen. It is always interesting to me that in a field as competitive as TV, radio, and the sports media, my race matters at all. In the meantime, my identity isn't locked up in whiteness any more than a black or Hispanic or Asian person's identity is locked up in their skin color. I choose every single one of my opinions, but I didn't choose to be white with green eyes and perfect brown hair. God just bless me with the best hair in the business. And for that, I will be eternally grateful. We aren't just seeing the world of sports attacked by liberal political forces. The idea of sports themselves is under attack. How long before football with its hyper-masculine attributes is sidelined? How long until cheerleaders are considered too sexist to exist? How long until it's not the best man or woman in competition, but the best man or woman from a particular background? How long until cosmetic diversity comes to sports? I think it's not too long at all. So many of you listening to this book right now are probably thinking, how do we take up arms against this absurdity? How do we keep sports from being overtaken by the far left in this country? How do we ensure that the country becomes more like sports and not that sports becomes more like the country. Well, let's say you agree with everything you've read from me in this book and are convinced, like my mom is, that I'm a genius. How does sports get back to just being about sports again, to being the place where sports fans go to escape the serious things in their life, to being a uniting force and not a dividing force? The positive thing is, I don't think it would be that difficult. In fact, I've got a handy four-part plan that would make sports great again. First, don't cover athlete political opinions as major news stories. Having been to hundreds of media availabilities over the years, I can tell you that little of what an athlete or coach says at media availabilities is worth a major news story. Often there is no news at all from these events because athletes and coaches tend to speak in banal cliches devoid of anything of substance. Answering questions while saying nothing has become a coach and athlete art form. In the past several years, many sports media companies, led by ESPN, have suddenly chosen to cover coach and player opinions on politics as major news stories. Why? My contention in this book is that this has happened because the sports media figures making decisions about this coverage agree with these coach and player political opinions and use those players as a voice to get their own political opinions out in a way that they never could have otherwise. But that's not fair and impartial sports journalism. That's using sports to advocate for your own political views. It's made doubly unfair when athletes are praised for their left-wing political opinions, which are shared by the left-wing sports media, and that praise encourages even more left-wing political pronouncements. Athletes are rarely, if ever, criticized for any left-wing political opinion, no matter how uninformed, uneducated, or just flat-out wrong those opinions may be. When they are criticized, they rapidly assert racism. Witness what happened when Fox News host Laura Ingraham ridiculed LeBron James's banal political opinions and told him to shut up and dribble. Immediately, the sports media reacted with outrage, defending James from an unfair attack upon his political beliefs. But all Ingraham had done was point out the banalities of James's political opinion, something she'd also done to San Antonio Spurs head coach Greg Popovich and countless entertainment figures over the years. In fact, Ingraham even invited James on her show to discuss his political opinions, an opportunity I've offered to Colin Kaepernick on my show as well. If James wants to step into the political arena, he shouldn't expect just to be praised for his political opinions. He should expect what everyone else in politics does. You have to defend your opinions against attacks from people who disagree with you. The fact that so many players recoiled from Ingram's criticism and immediately accused her of racism, despite the fact that Ingraham published her own book ridiculing the Dixie Chicks and other left-wing entertainers called Shut Up and Sing, demonstrates how coddled athletes have been by the sports media covering them. Athletes have grown used to only being praised for their political opinions, no matter how childlike those opinions may be. If Steve Kerr or Greg Popovich or LeBron James or Colin Kaepernick have the same political opinions you do, as seems likely given what we know about the sports media's own political voting history, then covering those men's political opinions isn't fair and balanced, it's propaganda. Why cover those political opinions at all? Are any of these athletes saying anything different from what many left-wing political commentators have been saying about Donald Trump for the past several years? Of course not. Plus, there are plenty of left-wing political commentators doing a great job of offering a full-throated condemnation of Trump's policies. Do you really think Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, LeBron James, or Colin Kaepernick are saying anything we haven't heard before? Of course not. All these men have a right to their own political opinions, just like all of you listening to this book right now have the right to yours too. The sports media doesn't need to provide a megaphone to broadcast those opinions far and wide while simultaneously extolling the virtues of the coach and player activism. And these political opinions certainly don't need to be considered legitimate sports media news. Again, read a transcript of a typical player or coach media press conference. You never even see 95% of the quotes because the media deems them not worthy of covering. The same is true of player decisions on whether or not to visit the White House. Do we really need the sports media to breathlessly cover which players, coaches, and teams will be going to the White House and which ones won't be going? Every player has the right to share his or her decision on whether or not to visit the White House on his or her social media platforms. But again, that's not breaking news. We don't need sports media commentators to debate whether or not players should attend the White House every time the president conveys an invitation to visit to a team that's won a championship. The solution is to not cover the political opinions of athletes or coaches as legitimate sports news. That's not the job of sports networks or sports media. Early in this book, I talked about my decision to take the red pill and begin to question the way I saw the sports media covering stories all around me. Once I made that decision and started to write and talk about the unfairness I saw in the sports media, I noticed something amazing. I started to get attacked all the time and branded as controversial. No one in the mainstream media ever said I was controversial when I was pro-choice or against the death penalty or believed in gay marriage, or when I worked on Al Gore's presidential campaign or Democratic congressional and Senate campaigns, or when I said I was voting for Barack Obama. The minute I started to question the liberal sports media orthodoxy, Politico wrote thousands of words and called me the darling of the alt-right in a headline. The Weekly Standard wrote thousands of words and called me the Alex Jones of sports media. Media Matters synthesized the two pieces, put me in a straitjacket in the graphics for their article, and called me a racist conspiracy theorist in their headline. The most interesting thing about all of these articles is they don't actually contest any of my opinions, they just attack me personally. Apparently, all it took to be the darling of the alt-right and to be the Alex Jones of sports media and to be a racist conspiracy theorist was to say that Michael Bennett was a liar and ESPN's politics were far left-wing. It was amazing to see. I was immediately attacked and branded as having unacceptable political opinions, all because I was willing to stand up to the prevailing left-wing orthodoxy in sports media and point out how transparently unfair it all was to average sports fans out there who look to sports as their escape from our polarized political era. Hell, if you doubt me at all, just wait and see what my critics will say about this book. Some people in the liberal sports media will react like I've just published Mein Kampf. Seriously, just wait. Of course, I'll immediately call all those critics racist and sexist, so make sure you follow me on Twitter, at Clay Travis, so you'll see it happen. That's despite the fact that many, even most reasonable people of a variety of political beliefs in America are going to read this book and agree with many of my positions. There's a clear attempt from left-wing sports media members to praise left-wing sports opinions and elevate those opinions to legitimate sports perspectives worthy of headline billing while personally denigrating anyone who speaks out against far left-wing hegemony. I'm sorry, LeBron James saying Donald Trump is a bum should not be a top ESPN headline. Yet, go figure, of course it was. LeBron was praised by left-wing ESPN commentators as being incredibly brave for saying it. To play a favorite game of left-wingers, let's flip the races. What if a white athlete had called Barack Obama a bum? What would have happened? He would have been called racist and publicly shamed for ever having that opinion at all. And his team might well have released him. Hell, just look at what happened to Kevin McHale for being in the crowd at a Donald Trump rally. Athlete and coach political opinions are not treated equally by left-wing sports media who are biased and favoring political opinions they agree with. So my first prong is, don't cover athlete and coach political opinions as legitimate news stories. I don't think most sports fans are looking for politics from their sports figures, and I don't think there's a strong business here. Put it this way, do you really think a left-wing sports media outlet would suddenly emerge and become worth hundreds of millions of dollars? Of course not. Slicing and dicing sports fans into disparate interest groups isn't just bad for America, it's also bad for business. ESPN tried to turn Nate Silver's news site, 538, into a business, and guess what happened? The site cost $9 million a year and made $3 million in revenue. It lost tons of money. The same thing is true of The Undefeated, ESPN's attempt to appeal to the black sports fans online. That site is losing tens of millions of dollars, and no one is reading it, despite prominent placement on ESPN.com. The same is also true for ESPNW and every other segmented sports site ESPN has tried to develop. Those sites don't work because sports is already inclusive. Everyone wants to read the same stories regardless of their race, gender, or ethnicity. The triumph of sports is that we all care about the same top athletes. Sports, when done and covered well and fairly, unites us instead of dividing us. There's a reason Michael Jordan sells more shoes than any other basketball player playing today. It's because he appeals to all of us, not a tiny segment of us. So my first prong would be this: don't cover athlete or coach political opinions as news. Second, if you're going to talk about politics intersecting with sports, have different political viewpoints involved in that discussion. This sounds simple, but it isn't happening right now. Witness what happened to Rush Limbaugh and Paul Feinbaum when they challenged the prevailing liberal orthodoxy on ESPN. If you feel the need to debate anything political at all in the world of sports, you can't just feature the liberal sports perspective. Even MSNBC and Fox News, as well as CNN, have learned they need individuals who represent both conservative and liberal viewpoints to debate issues. Otherwise, your broadcast turns into an echo chamber. If you want to embrace debate on sports broadcasts, then you need two legitimate sides to a debate. How amazing is it that ESPN doesn't employ a single person who has publicly announced he or she voted for Donald Trump? Not one person! Those people exist, but they saw what happened to Kurt Schilling, so they've kept their mouth shut. They know that thanks to Disney CEO Bob Iger, left-wing sports opinion makers get television shows and right-wing sports opinion makers get fired. It's not just ESPN either. CBS, NBC, Fox Sports, the NFL Network. Can you find one person presently employed on air at these places who has publicly stated he voted for Donald Trump? Because I can't. That's preposterous, because nearly 63 million people voted for Trump. Now, I know some of the people who did vote for Trump and work at those places. Don't worry, I'm not going to out you guys and girls, but that's how unbalanced the sports media has become. Half the country and 30 of our 50 states voted for Donald Trump, and he's our president right now, whether you like it or not. Yet there isn't one person who feels comfortable coming out and admitting to voting for Trump in the sports media. It's insane, and that's not a healthy marketplace of ideas. My position is that sports TV viewers don't care who the people who talk about sports voted for, but if you feel the need to cover politics endlessly as part of sports talk, then you need to find an entire cadre of people to debate the other side, the conservative sports fans' opinion. There are so few people doing that in the present day that a middle-of-the-road guy like me seems like a far-right winger in comparison to the far-left-wing obsession on sports television. Someone needs to feel comfortable ripping Colin Kaepernick on sports TV, even calling him an idiot for his protest. That's how real politics work. The marketplace of ideas is a brutal battlefield. You've got to be comfortable engaging in a spirited fray for the side you believe in, and you have to be willing to be insulted like crazy as part of that battle. I believe that if you provided two different sides to each of these political debates, fans would rapidly grow tired of the protracted struggle. They tune into sports for sports-related topics. If they want to see politics debated, they can turn on a bevy of news programming featuring the same conflicts. But maybe I'm wrong, and sports fans are craving sports to be mixed with politics all day. At least then you'd get a fair fight. We watch sports because we love to see even competitions. Two great teams battling to win. No one watches one-sided blowouts. Right now, when sports and politics intersect, it's a one-sided blowout. Far left-wing sports commentators praise far left-wing athlete opinions, and the general sports fans are left out of the conversation. Third, don't assume race is the root cause of every way that someone is treated in the world of sports. Recently, Lamar Jackson, a black quarterback, went through the NFL draft process, and some teams were interested in seeing Jackson, a Heisman Trophy winner at Louisville, run routes at wide receiver. The usual suspects at MSESPN and elsewhere took to the airwaves and social media streets to pronounce this clear evidence of racism. One of ESPN's top NFL analysts tweeted, "So Lamar Jackson, who won the Heisman and was college football's most dynamic player as a QB, can't play QB? Oh, and they, all caps, showed us that Johnny had first-round QB skills, exclamation point. Also made sure we knew that Baker just lets his leadership and competitiveness get the best of him sometimes. We hear you again." As I mentioned earlier in the book, a New York Daily News columnist also wrote a piece titled, "If Lamar Jackson Were White, He'd Be the First Quarterback Drafted." This is a transparent attempt to turn Lamar Jackson's being asked to run routes at wide receiver at the NFL Combine into an example of racism. Yet Tim Tebow, a Heisman Trophy winning quarterback at Florida, was also asked by multiple teams if he'd be willing to make a position switch at the NFL level. Many teams were interested in Tebow playing tight end or halfback. Eventually, Tebow gave up on football and moved on to baseball rather than switch from the quarterback position. As if that weren't enough, a Heisman Trophy winning white quarterback at Nebraska, Eric Crouch, was switched to defense to have a better shot at playing in the NFL. Defense! Matt Jones, a top SEC quarterback for Arkansas, switched his position to wide receiver before the NFL draft. As did black quarterbacks Braxton Miller and Terrell Pryor. Ironically, Pryor has become one of the top wide receivers in the game, banking tens of millions based on his receiving talents. Demonstrable evidence shows us that what is being asked of Lamar Jackson is not an uncommon occurrence for top white or black quarterbacks, even Heisman Trophy winning ones, in the modern era. Jackson has been erratic with his passes from the pocket, and NFL teams, justifiably, are nervous about whether a quarterback who hasn't demonstrated great talents passing from the pocket can survive trying to scramble in the more violent NFL. Moreover, as I stated earlier in the book, there have been four black quarterbacks drafted number one overall since 2001. The idea that Lamar Jackson is being treated differently based on his race is transparently not true. After all, remember, one of the two greatest quarterbacks of all time, Tom Brady, a white man, was drafted in the sixth round. Predicting that any quarterback will succeed going from college to the NFL is a crapshoot, and many times, regardless of race, NFL teams underrate or overrate a quarterback. Indeed, in the 2000 draft, when Tom Brady was famously picked in the sixth round, two black quarterbacks, T. Martin and Spurgeon Winn, were drafted before him. Was the NFL racist against Tom Brady because two black quarterbacks were taken in front of him? Or was the NFL just wrong about Brady, regardless of his race? Remember, Lamar Jackson was still drafted in the first round of the 2018 NFL draft and is now guaranteed millions of dollars. It's not like no one took him at all. Yet making a false racial claim is a fast way to garner likes and retweets on Twitter, and then ESPN and other sports media networks use that divisive rhetoric to ignite debate. Debate, which is, of course, wholly based on a false narrative predicated on fomenting racial division. Worst of all, as we saw with Limbaugh, that debate is only allowed to have one side. Racism is to blame. Because here's the deal. Does anyone really think the modern day NFL is biased against black quarterbacks? If bias did exist, Wouldn't the non-racist NFL teams start black quarterbacks and win one Super Bowl title after another? The fact of the matter is this. White guys have been better quarterbacks in the past 25 years than black guys. That doesn't mean black guys or Asian guys or Hispanic guys can't play quarterback better over the next 25 years. It just means that white guys have been better so far. I don't claim to understand why that is, but the truth of the matter is this. There aren't very many good NFL quarterbacks, regardless of race. The NFL, like all sports, is an ultimate meritocracy. The best player, regardless of race, class, religion, ethnicity, or state or country of upbringing, will play. That's why we all like sports. Yet it has become increasingly common for race baiting in sports to take place, and the race baiting always takes a common form, what I've called the A Time to Kill of sports. Remember in A Time to Kill when the lawyer Jake Brigance tells the jury to close their eyes after a stirring speech about a little girl who was raped and then says, "Now imagine she's white." And all the jurors open their eyes and they're like, "Holy hell, it turns out raping little girls is wrong. I never would have believed it if I hadn't thought she was white." That premise may have made more sense in 1988 Mississippi when the book came out, or even in the 1996 United States when it was released as a movie. But change the race narratives are all too common in modern day American sports. Almost always the sports figure is being treated exactly as his peers, black or white. Yet the change the race narrative is a common trope that's treated far too seriously by major sports networks, and it happens all the time. After white NFL quarterback Baker Mayfield was caught on camera grabbing his crotch in the direction of the Kansas sideline, ESPN's Kerry Champion tweeted, "You know why it could be considered a big deal? Because Cam Newton can't dab. Because if it were Lamar, would it be okay?" Yes, we have an ESPN employee here arguing that Baker Mayfield is receiving white crotch grab privilege. That's even though Mayfield's crotch grab received extensive coverage and ultimately led to a half-game suspension. Within a couple of weeks, black college players had scored touchdowns and mimicked peeing on a fire hydrant, Ole Miss's DK Metcalf, and mimicked jerking off on the opposing fan base, South Florida's Quentin Flowers. Both of these celebrations happened live on ESPN or ABC broadcast. Do you know how much coverage they received on ESPN? None. How about Lamar Jackson? Champion had wondered how he'd be received if he grabbed his crotch. He started a brawl on the sideline against his state rival team, Kentucky, in the final regular season game of his college career. The brawl resulted in multiple penalties and a sideline melee. The coverage, non-existent. Race rarely, if ever, impacts the way a story is covered in sports media when it comes to most athletes today. But when race is involved, it's far more likely that white athletes like Baker Mayfield receive more criticism than black athletes would today for doing the same thing. That's because most members of the sports media are so hypersensitive to racism allegations that white players are attacked far more aggressively than their black counterparts. Far from being penalized by the media based on their race, the reverse is true. Black athletes are much less likely to be challenged because of their race, because the media either supports them or is afraid of being called racist. See Michael Bennett and LeBron James. Flipping someone's race as a point of legitimate discussion shouldn't be a regular debate in modern day sports. It's simply not accurate in our modern media era, and it serves to divide sports fans and artificially inflame racial tensions. I've got a crazy idea. How about we treat everyone the exact same, regardless of their race? In my opinion, the first person to accuse another person of being racist or sexist is acknowledging they don't have the power to win an argument using facts, logic, or thinking skills. Spending less time fixating on false racial divisions in sports and rewarding those who make an entire career doing so would also help to depoliticize sports. Fourth, the leagues have to mandate that players not engage in political statements while in uniform at work. If you want to argue the national anthem is a political statement, you are certainly welcome to argue that position. but the vast majority of American sports fans disagree with you. Every pro sports league in America has decided having players present on the field for the national anthem is good for their business. This happens in the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, and the NHL. The NBA players and coaches have been incredibly outspoken with their political beliefs, but they have all stood for the national anthem before every game. As we saw with Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, the NBA refused to allow any player not to stand for the anthem back in 1996 and hasn't had an issue since then. There has been no controversy surrounding the NBA's on-court product other than player and coach-related drama dealing directly with basketball itself. Ratings have not been impacted negatively. In fact, they were up in both 2017 and 2018. NBA ratings remain, however, drastically lower than they were when Michael Jordan's reign of apolitical dominance prevailed in the 1990s. The NFL owners and their commissioner Roger Goodell could have ordered Colin Kaepernick to stand for the national anthem, as was already mandated by league rules, or face substantial financial consequences for his failure to do so. As stated earlier in the book, it's a fallacy to suggest players have unlimited First Amendment rights on the field. They're fined for inappropriate touchdown celebrations, wearing the wrong shoes or socks, and are subject to a variety of league rules while in uniform on the field. Players can even be fined for the language they use on the field, as Colin Kaepernick should well remember, since he was fined for using a racial slur several years ago. NFL players, like every other employee in the country, are subject to the rules and regulations of their workplace. If they choose to violate those workplace obligations, then NFL team owners have the right to levy fines for those decisions. NFL owners may decide they don't want to continue the negative off-field attention and might elect to levy suspensions on players who violate league rules. That's entirely appropriate too. Regardless, the pro sports leagues have to end the idea that player political protests, no matter the cause, in uniform at work are permissible. Sure, the negative media attention for enforcing a rule already on the books may be troubling in the short term, but the league has already created a massive mess for two consecutive years by hoping this controversy was just going to subside. The result has been nearly a 20% drop in ratings, which would be calamitous for any business. If a team signs Colin Kaepernick and he agrees to stand for the national anthem, this story is effectively ended. Why couldn't a team sign Kaepernick and agree to donate an amount equal to his salary to charities of his choice, and in exchange, Kaepernick agrees to stand for the anthem? That seems like a reasonable compromise that would go a long way toward bringing back fans to the game. I think undertaking all four of these steps would help return sports to the role that they have played for much of American history as a unifying and not a divisive force in American life. In 2011, I was fired from FanHouse along with just about everyone else when the company sold its site traffic on AOL.com to Sporting News. The loss of my job then turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me because I started my website, Outkick the Coverage, that summer, and my career path has been like a rocket ship since then. Ultimately, the larger American marketplace, especially at the highest levels, is still a meritocracy. The best and most talented people rise to the top. I truly believe that. Which is why the lessons of sports are ultimately conservative. The only hand you can rely on is the one at the end of your sleeve. Think about all the locker rooms you've ever been inside. When you lost a game, did your coach walk into the locker room and rail about the structural inequities of life, the fact that the kids you were playing against may have had better facilities than you did, or more privileges in life? Did he make excuses about larger societal trends that doomed your team to lose before the game began? Or did he tell you to look deep within yourself and find the strength for you and your teammates to get better? Did he ask you to work harder and make sacrifices to succeed? I've never met a successful coach who blamed the larger world for his team's loss. I've never met a successful athlete who did that either. That's because sports competition gets the country right. It's pure and honest and fair, Lance Armstrong and his ilk notwithstanding. Sports are about learning personal responsibility and work ethic, about the values of teamwork, about treating everyone on your team equally, and encouraging everyone to succeed. It's about learning how to marshal your own talents and abilities to the best of your ability, and about not blaming others when you or your team comes up short in the end. You should have worked harder. You should have been better. You shouldn't have left the decision to an umpire or referee. You should have strived harder for perfection than you did. In the end, we all, no matter how successful we may become, fail at sports. It hurts to fail, but it's also ennobling. We are a country made up of strivers, men and women who refuse to accept failure no matter the obstacles before them. We uniquely in this world are made up of people whose ancestors weren't born here. Just about every single one of us carries the blood of a fearless warrior inside of us, someone who stepped off a ship, either voluntarily or involuntarily, onto virgin land and created the greatest and most successful democratic experiment in the history of the world. America's not a place, it's a vision, an ideal. And ultimately what it is rooted in is two simple words. Be better. Think about those two words when you wake up and you go to bed. Was I better today than I was yesterday? Can I be better tomorrow than I was today? If your answer is yes every single day, then there truly is no limit to how high you will climb, to how far you will be able to see from the mountaintop of the American meritocracy. Every single one of us is made up of the DNA of strivers, people who saw what was and dared to fearlessly reach for what could be. You don't conquer a continent with meek middle management dreams. You don't reach for the stars and beyond without an existential and unending quest to be better. That's what sports is, the relentless pursuit of that which hasn't been done before, a never-ending battle against complacency, the quest to do what many believe is impossible. Why are you listening to this book right now? Because of the lessons I learned from sports long ago. We don't need to make sports look like America. We need to make America look more like sports. With your help, I still believe, despite all the contradictions and absurdities and biases, sports can still be the one place we go in America where, regardless of our races, genders, ethnicities, and sexual orientations, we can all be equal. Because in the end, victory doesn't see color, and neither does defeat. Epilogue. In the fall of 2004, I began writing online with several friends at a website one of my college classmates built. We called that website deadlyhippos.com, and we wrote with the goal of entertaining ourselves and whatever small segment of the population might also be entertained by our daily musings. We wrote about sports and pop culture and the things that were happening in our lives. We were a motley crew, a few friends from law school, a high school buddy, and his friend from college, and a college friend of mine, Chris Shaw, who had built our website. When the website started, we were all 25 years old, and I was the only one of us who was married. Now we all have two or more kids and busy lives with young children. But back then, every day when I arrived to practice law, I would check the website counter, which existed in the bottom right corner of the website. It would tick up every day, sometimes quite slowly. I vividly remember driving home from my law office one day, writing online was my escape from the drudgery of practicing law, and wishing as deeply as a person could wish that one day I might have 100 daily readers. 1,000 was a fanciful pipe dream. 10,000, pure insanity. I didn't even dare to think above 10,000 readers. For years, I wrote without making a dollar off my words. On the day I turned 30, I accepted a full-time job at FanHouse paying me $25,000 a year. 2 years later, I was fired from that job along with just about everyone else at the website. And I had a wife at home with a baby, my second son, and my yearly income was $45,000. I was 32 years old, not old, but not very young either, and I had two young sons and no idea what I was going to do. I'd written two books, I had a local radio show that was doing well, but I wasn't thriving. I was stuck. Should I give up writing and talking about sports and go back to practicing law? Abandon the 7 years of work I'd put in to make a small living in this world of sports? I remember going to a minor league baseball game that spring. It was sparsely attended in my hometown of Nashville, and we sat down close to the dugout. The local team, the Nashville Sounds, were losing, and a few drunken fans sat down close to the field and mercilessly trash-talked the AAA baseball players as they each came up to bat, denigrating their batting averages, their weight, any and every detail was sport for the drunken revelers. As I sat and listened to those fans' jeers, I felt just like the AAA baseball players. They were so close to the major leagues, having put in years and years of hard work to reach where they were, and yet they still had no guarantee they'd ever reach the promised land. The major leagues, the destination they'd been pursuing their entire lives. Every week from 2004 to the present, as I moved from the site we founded with friends to CBS, Deadspin, and FanHouse, there had been thousands of words from me online. Every week and every month and every year over the past 7 years, my audience had grown. I felt like I was a major league talent, but I certainly wasn't being paid like it. Heck, I barely even had a livable wage when you factored in my law school loans. Did it matter what I thought if no one else in the marketplace agreed? Not long after that baseball game, I went on a sales call with my local radio station in Nashville. I was doing advertisements on our daily radio show for a hair replacement company. At that meeting, the advertiser wrote a check for 6 months of ads. The check was for $50,000. I remember looking at him sign that check and salivating. Here, right in front of me, was one advertiser paying $50,000 more than I'd make in an entire year for me to do local radio ads for. That's the moment I decided to start my own website, Outkick the Coverage. In the summer of 2011, I started that website. I would do everything, write, edit, and sell ads. My goal was to make $60,000 that first year. If I could do that, I'd have a six-figure salary if you combine that money with my radio deal, which was my goal. On the day I launched the website crashed because we had too much traffic. 7 years later, there are days we do 1 million readers on the site. There are also days when millions more will listen to me on radio, watch me on TV, or check out my daily Periscope and Facebook Live shows. In 2004, I had an audience of zero, and today I have an audience in the millions. Some of you listening to this book right now were part of that initial 100 readers, of that initial 1,000, of that first halcyon day when I had 10,000 readers. When I started writing online, I could have never foreseen what Outkick would become or that a book like this might ever exist. I was, quite simply, the same as many of you listening to this book are right now, a guy with a dream. I wanted to make a living as a writer and be as smart, original, funny, and authentic as I could every single day. All of you reading this book right now have a dream of your own, but there are probably reasons you aren't pursuing that dream. Maybe those reasons even make sense. Maybe you're making too much money doing what you do now, or you have young kids, or you don't have the time. Ultimately, all of those are excuses. And if you make enough excuses, something rotten happens inside your soul. You stop being a dreamer. And worse than not being a dreamer, you use your own fears as fuel to attack other people you see pursuing their dreams. All of us, no matter where we live or what race, gender, ethnicity, or sexual orientation we are, have been surrounded by these kinds of people. Those that aren't happy in their own lives and decide to take it out on others. Honestly, that's the lifeblood of social media. Look at the people who attack you. How often are they more successful than you are? Almost never. I wasn't born rich. Neither of my parents ever made $50,000 a year in their jobs, and none of my grandparents graduated from college. But I was incredibly wealthy when it came to the support of my immediate family. My parents and grandparents were absolutely fabulous, and they encouraged me in everything I did. While a parent or grandparent's support can be crucial, it can also be overlooked. My mom is still convinced I'm the best-looking person to ever do sports on television. That's nice and all, Mom, but have you seen Kirk Herbstreit and Joel Klatt? My mom is such a fan that I had to ban her from commenting on my articles because she was fighting with people saying bad things about me online. My wife, by the way, like many wives, is the exact opposite. Every now and then she'll read one of my articles and say, I kind of agree with the commenters. You do suck. So many of you, like me, probably expect and receive encouragement from your parents, and I know some of you don't, and that's just awful. But what I've found is support from people you don't necessarily expect can make all the difference. Early in my writing career online, my Uncle Hugh read one of my articles and said, you know, I think you can make a living doing this someday. At the time, I was making $100 a week writing online. Yes, it was a family member, but my uncle made a living as a banker. He didn't give compliments just to give compliments. His opinion then and now mattered a great deal to me. Shortly thereafter, I was standing at a Vanderbilt University tailgate with one of my law school classmates, Kelly Warman. Kelly, who is now the best real estate attorney in Nashville, and I were drinking beers before Vanderbilt lost a football game to someone. I don't remember the opponent, but I'm confident Vanderbilt was on the losing side because, well, they're Vanderbilt, and it's football. A reader came up to me and wanted a picture, and when that reader left, Kelly, a fan of my writing, said, you know, I think one day you're going to make $1 million a year doing what you do. I remember laughing at his pronouncement. At the time, I would have signed my life away for $100,000 a year, but he was right. Kelly's comment coupled with my uncle's are two that have stuck with me ever since. I'm sure there have been other positive comments like these two along the way, but both of those comments meant more to me than I think either guy knew at the time. That's why I want to close this book with one more thought. Yes, there have been many opinions in these pages, and some of them may have angered you or made you want to throw the book across the room. Others you may well have agreed with. I've come to accept that in the minds of many, I'm either the devil incarnate or the prince of peace, because that's the world we live in today. Everything is either the best or the worst. There is no middle ground. But regardless of whom you root for or what your political persuasions are, if you've made it this far in the book, I want you to do something for me. Look for people around you who are working hard at something, and tell them you appreciate their talent and believe in them. And I don't mean people like me. At this point, I get plenty of love and hate every day. I mean people like me 10 years ago. There are millions of them all over this country, people pouring their heart and soul into everything they do with very few people noticing their work at all. Trust me, the right word delivered at the right time means everything, and it can be the difference between success and failure. It's why I'm here today, producing all the content I do, the guy you love to hate or hate to love. Just a kid from Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks to y'all, I live my dream every day, and for that, and for all of you reading or listening right now, whether you love or hate me, I am eternally grateful. This is Clay Travis, This production of Republicans Buy Sneakers 2, How the Left is Ruining Sports with Politics, presented by Broadside Books and Harper Audio, was directed by Paul Fowley and recorded at Castle Recording Studios in Williamson County, Tennessee. Engineered by Chris Rozovsky, it was produced by Common Mode,